Helgeson, and I'm coming to you from KIVA AM 1600 in beautiful downtown Albuquerque. Well, actually, it's uptown Albuquerque. Well, welcome, everyone. As I said, that's my name, Stefan Helgeson, and this is the Project Pushback Half Hour. I'm a retired U.S. diplomat, and I had the good fortune to live and work around the world for about 25 years. I retired 15 years ago to New Mexico, but retirement didn't quite suit me. So I accepted the governor's offer of a position as the director of the Office of Science and Technology, a job I held for nearly 4 years. That was until Governor Bill Richardson found out I was a conservative and eliminated the job along with 52 other jobs. Well, I learned about how this state really works from the inside. And believe me, it wasn't always a pretty sight, but it was always interesting. These days, I'm a political analyst and observer and have written a number of books, a couple of them co-authored with my guest today. But the newest book is The 11th Hour, How You Can Push Back the Liberal Left. Well, last spring, I felt the need to do more to get conservatives elected, so I started Project Pushback as a way to encourage all of you to stand up and be counted in this never-ending fight for America's values. Every morning at the crack of dawn, I research the top 15 conservative websites to find stories that I think will interest you. I then bundle them together and send out an email with links to those stories to save you the time and trouble of doing it. If you want me to put you on my distribution list to get those stories, just send me your email address. You can do that by logging on to www.projectpushback.com and go to the Contacts section. Well, you know, every once in a while I have a special guest on the program, and this week I'm very pleased to have Lance Tarrance with me. Lance is a person very well known in Washington, D.C. circles and around the country as one of the U.S.'s top pollsters. I'll repeat that. He's one of the top U.S. pollsters in the country, and he's one of the few people to be inducted into the Pollsters Hall of Fame, and he's in with good company. To go through his resume, though, would take up most of this program, but I'd like to mention at the outset that I've had the privilege of co-authoring two books with him, both of them on the Republican Party. As I said, Lance has been involved in politics, well, maybe I didn't, for over a half century. He's worked on presidential campaigns and state campaigns on his own and with his polling company, Tarrance Consulting. Before that, he was in the Nixon administration, I'm betraying his age a little bit, working in the Census Bureau. After selling his company to Gallup a few years ago, Gallup made him their man in China for a time. He now writes articles for Gallup's website. He and his wife, Debbie, moved from Texas to Santa Fe, I believe it was back in 2012, if I'm not mistaken. Correct. And ever since then, he's been active in New Mexico politics. Thank goodness. We need people of the caliber of Lance Tarrance to be involved in our politics. But I'll let Lance fill you in on more himself. So, Lance, welcome. But would you mind telling our listeners a little now, not a half hour's worth of what I didn't cover?
Well, not much. You've done an excellent job.
Well, thank you, Lance.
And it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
And it's a pleasure to be in New Mexico. I know Washington, D.C. probably better than I do any other place in the United States even today. But I'm happy to be here. The time I spent at Gallup on the board of directors for 5 years gave me a sense of national, not only data, but the national policy directions. And I'm going to hold on to that, so I still write for them.
Lance, could I ask you when you first started getting interested in politics?
Well, everybody has a kind of a special moment. And I just graduated from Washington Lee University in Virginia, being from Texas originally. Read The Conscience of a Conservative by Barry Goldwater. At least he authored it. And found out I didn't know much about government that I hadn't gotten in college, so I immediately signed up for the Goldwater campaign out of college, and the rest is history.
Wow. And you spent a fair amount of your life working to elect candidates, Republican candidates, in Texas. Is that correct?
Yes, but I started with Senator Tower. Everybody has a kind of a legendary pathway to Washington in many ways, and mine was through John Tower. And then after that, I got later involved with the Republican National Committee, worked there, and then ended up with the Ronald Reagan polling firm in California. And that's really was the inspiration to set up my own company.
So you went from D.C. and the Virginia area to directly to California?
Well, I had 1 year where I taught a course at Harvard, but that was simply like a doctoral dissertation in a way. But ended up back in Texas because you could see the revolution was beginning to turn the state from a one-party state to at least a two-party state, and I was there to help start it.
Wow. That must have been really exciting for a young man, as you said before, to work to elect Barry Goldwater. What was the mood of the country like at that time?
Somewhat like today. There was quite a bit of dissension about the way the country was going. As you know, the re-election of John F. Kennedy was supposed to be the big pairing of the two. There were even some polls showing that Goldwater had a chance to beat the incumbent because of some of the international things, Cuban missile crisis, et cetera. So things were quite open. There was quite a bit of dissension in the country. And, of course, the assassination made it even worse.
But Barry Goldwater seemed to be a kind of irascible character. Was he really?
No. There was a book written about him, and I was in it in several places. And one of the things I said was he spoke not only the truth, but he spoke it fast and quick and made sure everybody understood where he was. And he made quite a transition in his life from being somebody who was supposed to be blowing up the world to telling Nixon maybe it was time to leave. So he had quite a career.
You know, it's strange the things we remember from that time, but I remember a bumper sticker that said AUH24 or something like that.
Yeah,
Gold water.
if you're a chemist.
Yeah, that's right.
But that was a great election to go through because as a young person, I know what it is to be defeated and what we did right and wrong. And it helped kind of mobilize my thinking for the next 20 years.
So after you dipped your big toe into the political waters and got a taste of a national political campaign, I'm interested to know how you transitioned to statewide races and races for four state offices like Senator Tower, you mentioned, and congressional races.
Well, first of all, I had to go through quite a few years of preparation. Being at the Census Bureau was one of them. Being at Harvard for a year on public policy was another one. But when I did start my own company, I specialized mainly in state races, governor's races, and House races, because that's where the weakest link was at that point, particularly in the western states of the so-called Sun Belt. So basically, it was a natural transition. There are many statements by governors who said that they'd rather be a governor than a senator anytime because people pick him up at the House and take him everywhere he wants to go. But that's where the real power is in terms of changing the realignment of the parties would have been at the state governorships.
Well, we've all seen how governorships are really, really important races to win, especially here in New Mexico. But before we move on to local politics, which I'm interested to get your take on, I'd like you to tell me about your time at the Census Bureau and maybe why getting a good, accurate census is important for America.
Well, first of all, it's most people maybe do not know. It's mandated word by word in the Constitution. And it says, basically, that to be able to apportion the House of Representatives fairly along population standards, that there'd have to be a census of the inhabitants of the United States. The first one was 1790. Inhabitants doesn't mean citizens or non-citizens, just whoever lives here. And that was the basis for the House of Representatives. The quality of the census is getting under quite a bit of scrutiny because it's with 330 million people. How do you do it? Very easily, you don't. In fact, I looked it up. This census purportedly is going to be a $15 billion exercise. That's quite a bit of money just to find out who lives here. But what's happened is the national government has grown over time. Instead of asking just age, sex, race, and household composition, which was the original set of questions, now we ask, let's say, 100 questions.
It's
about
amazing.
Everything.
It's amazing. Do marketing companies and polling companies, it seems that they may even help to construct the census questions on their own. Is there any kind of working partnership between the private sector
No.
and government? Not at all.
No, there's a lot of nonprofit research foundations that are heavily involved in the census. And of course, there's lobbying pressures, as in any government instrument. There's quite a bit of that. But basically, it's a once every 10 years, take a look at America. That becomes the so-called framework for everything we do in the country, not just in portioning the House of Representatives, but a lot of the distribution of federal funds. So there is a tremendous pressure to count everybody. And everybody has their own ways of saying, I think the census in my state is right or it's wrong. Most of the time they say it's wrong because they want more numbers. So it's quite a game.
But if you're looking at the census as strictly a payoff, if you will, or a promise made by the Constitution to enumerate the citizens, or excuse me, the residents of the United States, then all of these other questions should be superfluous. How did all these other questions get into the census?
Well, lobbying, special interest groups, they want to use the government to do a lot of their own research. So they petition the census to put certain questions on. And it's gotten probably out of control. The census is beginning to make some adjustments by doing the American Community Survey every 3 years of about 60,000 households, so they can get a lot of interim data and not have to depend upon just the census. But nevertheless, $15 billion is a lot of money to try to count 330 million people, of which maybe 20% don't want to be counted.
And the latest question that was so hotly debated, at least last year, I don't know if it's still so hotly debated, or even if it did make it into the census documents, is that one that asked if there were any non-U.S. citizens resident in these homes. Do you know what happened to that?
Yes. We've always asked citizenship as a question up through the 1950 census. Now, who decided to eliminate it in the future, we don't know. I don't know. But doesn't really make a whole lot of argument to say you shouldn't put it on there if it's been on there for many, many decades. But we've got special interest groups who want to diversify the country in a way that doesn't include citizenship.
Well, I'm talking with Lance Tarrance, former head of his own polling company in Washington, D.C. for many, many years, and now a proud resident of New Mexico living up in Santa Fe. And Lance, thanks again for coming. And I'd like to talk a little bit about polling, since that's really in your wheelhouse. You cut your teeth on polling and have probably influenced a generation or two of people who've gotten into the business since you were in there at its heyday. But polling has changed an awful lot, I guess, since you started out in the 70s. What have we learned that will help us have more faith in the polls? Because, as you very well know, most of the polls got Donald Trump's election wrong in 2016. Should we just view the polls as a peek through the doorway to voters' minds, or should we really take them very seriously?
Well, first of all, most pollsters will tell you it's only a snapshot in time, and it is a slice of America based on some random probability techniques. But the truth of the matter is the polls really weren't wrong, were not wrong at the national level. The only trouble is they were national polls, which includes, for example, California and New York, which tend to skew the results nationally in many ways. So the Hillary Clinton actually won by 2%. Most of the national polls averaged out at 2%. But that's not the way we elect a president. We elected on the Electoral College. And what happened, which could be a fault to the system, was nobody was taking very many polls in the states that counted. And we all have a fascination with the so-called target states that are being campaigned in, whether it's, you wouldn't think Nevada would be very important, or Wisconsin, we do think New York and California. But the truth of the matter is, it takes 270 electoral college votes based upon the 50 states in the District of Columbia. And what happened was, for example, in Wisconsin, which seems to surprise the Democrats the most, along with Pennsylvania, was that they'd counted on union support, other kinds of bedrock Democratic turnout groups that didn't do their job, or they didn't know they were in trouble because there was a hidden vote in those states and there were not enough state polls to suggest that there could be some differences in the Electoral College. So, make a long story short, polls were okay nationally, but we don't base our presidency on a direct popular election. And so by not doing enough in the states, they're going to make that that problem will not be made again.
That was my next question. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the pollsters have learned from their mistakes, and the candidates for that matter too, in 2016 and in 2020 will rectify that and do more polling?
Well, there'll be more target state polling, right. There's no doubt. You'll get 8 or 10 polls in Wisconsin in the last 6 weeks rather than none. Is this last election.
Michigan as well, I suspect.
And those as well. But there's also a deeper root cause of some of this. We're in a process of realigning the political parties in this country. It comes every so often. Some say it comes about every 30 to 40 years. But the blue-collar, white, working-class, non-college-educated person is no longer a lockstep in the Democratic Party. And on the other hand, the super-educated businessman living in New York City is no longer reliably Republican. So once you're going through these transformations, it does throw off some of the expectations and the so-called paradigms of voting that we use.
Fascinating. Also, one of the things that has changed, I believe, is that pollsters are not using landline customers as much as they used to, but are moving to mobile phone users.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yes, you bet. Well, of course, the country is moving that way. And in my house, we have cell phones only. For example, the only fixed line is to operate the security system or the Internet. But the truth of the matter is, just a few years ago, polls would in their mythological statements, would talk about we have, you know, included 10% cell phones. Now, they'll say they're concluding 60% of their samples in cell phones. Now, what's happened is we've got a sampling frame of the country that has to basically hit all the states, coterminous states at least, and have to use the probability statistics to derive an expectation with sampling error of, you know, plus or minus 3% or whatever it may be. So that is has changed somewhat, is the cell phone participation. But more than that is the advent of online polling. Many polling firms who are upset about the rising cost of polling because of the telephone interviewing cost and labor cost have developed samples off of online polling files, online computer files, so that the Internet may supply, let's say, 5,000 farmers out there in America that decided they would be happy to answer any questions. They're on a file. And then you go back and maybe randomly pick 500 at very low cost, to give somebody an idea of what farmers in America think. So for special segments of the population, online polling is efficient, quick, and very affordable. But it's very not well-liked in the political polling, where we have to be almost always certain of everything we say. And they say that polling is the ABC science, almost being certain. But we have to be more careful, so we need to get some of the tonality of the polling through telephone interviewing, where we can capture verbatim statements, et cetera, and feel like we know more of what's going on in the country. So all the classic polls in national presidential elections, the quality ones, the gold standard ones, tend to be full telephone interviewing, face-to-face over the phone. But there's an advent of an awful lot of online polling that gets mixed up, and nobody knows the difference sometime. And there is a different methodology, and there may be a bigger difference in quality.
I wanted to ask you about the structuring of questions in the polls themselves. That's always right. Bothered me, because there are those questions they ask you a kind of yes or no, a binary question where you have to answer fully in the positive or fully in the negative. And I see these questions as being kind of unfair to ask, in a sense, because you're not going to get a real readout of the person's belief. I don't know if I'm explaining myself well enough here, but what do you think?
I don't think it's that much of a problem. There is an art and a science to everything we do in this world. This is the art, questionnaire design. There are all kinds of systematic biases can be in a questionnaire. You can release a question to the press, let's say, but maybe the three questions that were before that were pushing in a certain direction. Yes, we have to be careful of the design of questions, but most of the national polling today has maybe 15 out of 25 questions that are generic, meaning that every pollster asks it the same way. Gallup has never asked the question, do you approve or disapprove of the job the president is doing? Everybody copies that question because they know it's a gold standard. So there's not a problem there, but there is a problem when we start fishing, trying to find out if you knew this, would you still vote this way and that way? Those tend to be more for campaign stratagems and not for public dissemination.
I've also wondered to myself, are polls that are weighted too heavily Democrat or too heavily Republican, are they going to give us the right stuff, the right information at the end of the day?
Well, first of all, there should be a methodological statement to every poll if it's released to the press. Those are part of the American Association of Public Opinion Research rules. But the question that you're asking, mentioning
well,
again.
I hear or see these polls thrown out by CNN or other TV stations and,
right.
and so forth. And I'm wondering to myself, if they don't show it up on the screen, what percentage of those people were actually Democrats or Republicans?
Well, they know, and we also know what the normal vote is, if you want to use those terms, normal vote. For example, among the public at large, if you ask party identification, which political party do you mostly belong to, and if you're an independent, which way do you lean, it comes out to about a six-point advantage to the Democrats. You go to the registered voter population or universe in the country, and it's about a three-point Democratic. You go to more likely voters, and we're talking about likely voters this time coming up being about 150 million people that will vote in 2020, it's dead even. And we know that from not only the reproducibility of all the other pollings that have been done in the past. Well, we've got census data, not on party ID, but we know what the household composition is, the right, for example, the African-American population should be about 12.5% in a national poll. If for some reason you only get 6.5%, you need to weight it up to the normal population level. So that's permissible. That's good. What happens is some of the polling, they get overly excited about weighting, and sometimes they weight too many variables. But most variables should be weighted, or most surveys should be weighted on race, on age, because we know older people will pick up the phone easier than younger people, and it'll also be weighted on party ID. Those are the three that are really critical.
Do you remember when Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan were in their final debate? And Reagan went into the debate. The polls were showing him significantly down. And after his performance in the debate, where he said his famous line to Carter, "Well, there you go again," another poll was taken just before the election, and it showed a tremendous bump for him. Was the poll before that time wrong, or did Reagan's performance, do you think, really change his standing?
Something like 70 million people are watching that debate. And any time you have an intervening event like that, that will help, you know, strengthen or weaken the support for any candidate. You go into any presidential election with, let's say, 45-45, let's say, in theory, and then there's that 6% either way or 7% that can move, and that's what makes the difference. Most of the elections, frankly, in this country are already settled. And by that I mean that the partisanship is so strong and solid that there's very few percentages that are really movable in elections. So you're spending literally in a presidential campaign, perhaps, $100 billion or so, or $100 million, so to speak, to move about 6 or 7 points.
Fascinating. I know you follow polls because not only was it your avocation and your business, but you find it extremely interesting. If you could tell our listeners, and by the way, for those of you just tuned in, I'm talking to Lance Tarrance, a former very successful pollster, Washington, D.C. fame, and who now lives in our beautiful state of New Mexico. So, Lance, which are the most accurate or best polls that our listeners should follow?
Well, I just saw a report the other day about trying to differentiate between lousy polls and the gold standard polls. Well, there are a lot of politically oriented people that got in the polling business. A lot of them are using online polling because it's cheap and quick. Those tend to be dismissed by the stronger analysts in D.C. particularly. But the best gold standard polls, obviously, are Gallup, which has been doing it since 1936. You've got the Pew Foundation does great polling. Then you have people like the New York Times and Washington Post pulling their own, and LA Times, pulling their own polls together using very high academic standards. Frankly, there's probably, you have other universities that throw it out every election year.
Like Monmouth, for example?
Or Quinnipiac, or some of these. Nobody knows much about them at all. We presumably they're good, but we don't have the external observation that we do on some of these. So I would stick with the major newspapers and the major institutions.
Do you think that the election of 2020, statewide elections, national elections, is going to include much more polling than previous elections?
After this last election, you would have to say very much so. The reason is that people began to fall into the kind of a syndrome that if all the polls are showing Hillary Clinton ahead, then she must be the winner without any problem. And we didn't look at the individual states. Secondly, a lot of polling today goes back and re-interviews people from 6 weeks ago to see if they can detect shifts. And sometimes that can change your entire view of the election if you see a certain shift occurring. There's so many people polling that that pretty much they'll all get it pretty much right. The problem in the future is going to be with all the money being spent in campaigns and with the media basically listening to every breath you take, not just your words, we're going to have polling done right up to the end to see if there's been any changes. So,
and will the impeachment hearings also make that more of a probability?
So far it looks like theater, not anything judicial. But basically, a lot of people in this country, probably 80% or more, have a pretty fixed idea who they're going to vote for, no matter who the nominee is. You couldn't have said that 50 years ago in this country, but boy, can you now. And then secondly, that means that, for example, people forget that the incumbent president, President Donald Trump, normally gets about a 3-point advantage being an incumbent and running for a second term. America's always been very lenient about giving you an 8-year term. Very seldom, George Bush did not have that happen to him in 1992. In Carter, too, but those were sort of unusual circumstances. But by and large, Trump should be an advantage. You wouldn't know that from looking at the press. But the press is not friendly to Trump because he's not part of their deep state, as he would say.
That's a conversation we need to have in a follow-up interview, and I'd love to have you back again. But I know that you cut your teeth on Texas politics and Texas races and lived many, many years in the Houston area. Mm-hmm. But you've been living now for the past 6 or 7 years here in New Mexico and have had a chance to look at us from the inside, if you will. In a minute or so, could you tell us your observations about New Mexico politics?
Well, it kind of surprises me that we have really a state that is not just red and green chili or red and blue politics. It's rural and urban, and the rural areas here are quite prominent. Secondly, you've got old families that maybe from the original, patron families or so forth in various parts of the state that still have a strong hold. Somebody laughed the other day and said it's not New Mexico, it's still Old Mexico. There's so many things that are not similar to Colorado, for example, or Arizona, or Texas, right next door to each of those states.
Well, we're transitioning. I think I've been here 15 years now, and I've seen a lot of changes. Some I really like, some I don't. But Lance, I'm sorry we have to close out our interview so quickly. Time has just run by so fast. I want to thank you very much for coming down and being my guest today. And I hope you will come back if we invite you back again for a second interview. Will you do that?
For you, I will always do that.
Ah, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to the Project Pushback Half Hour. We come at you every Saturday at 4 p.m. And we thank you for listening. And remember, if you'd like to have me put you on my distribution list for my morning email, send me your email at www.projectpushback.com. Thanks again, and go out there and be unafraid. Stay engaged. Your voice makes a difference. Don't forget to tune in next week to the station that gives you the best conservative talk in all of New Mexico, KIVA. So long for now.